Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for February 26, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks, at this time at the world of economics and politics. And a bit of a departure tonight, almost the first half of the program will be about that controversial subject, sex, and the politics of sex, to lend a little note of high-mindedness to the enterprise. I'll be interviewing, playing an interview recorded the other day with Susie Bright, the noted author. Author most recently of a book called Mommy's Little Girl on sex, motherhood, porn, and cherry pie. And we'll talk about a whole variety of issues in the intersection of sex and politics. And then at about the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Frieda Berrigan, who's with the World Policy Institute, talking about who's making a killing on arms contracts in Iraq. It's not just Halliburton, but they are the lead making a killing enterprise over there, but they've got some colleagues. And then about 5:45, we'll speak with Mark Levitan, who is the author of a report just out from the Community Service Society, A Crisis of Black Male Employment, Unemployment and Joblessness in New York City in 2003. It was not a good year for most workers in New York City, but especially bad for black men, and we'll talk to Mark Levitan about that. And since the plate is full tonight, let me just say a few words about the economic news. Commerce Department reported this morning that durable goods, that is, goods lasted designed to last 3 years or more, orders for those fell in January, but most of that was because of a decline in demand for transportation equipment, aircraft and motor vehicles. The economically interesting component of this report is expenditures on capital goods, that is, business expenditures on plant equipment, machinery, and such. And that was up for the second month in a row, took a steep dive in November, and the last 2 months have more than reversed that dive. But the revival in spending on capital goods, investment spending by corporations, is absolutely necessary for a vigorous economic recovery. We're seeing a choppy recovery in that statistic. It's picking up, but is nowhere near boom levels yet, so we've got a ways to go. And What the really important thing for human beings is what's happening with jobs. And the news there is, as it's been, getting better, but very, very slowly. And we're seeing, for example, this morning the government, the Labor Department reported that initial claims for unemployment insurance, that is, people who've just lost their jobs and signing up for unemployment insurance benefits, that rose by 6,000 last week. A bit more than most people were expecting. And although that statistic was in a greatly improving trend throughout the spring, summer, and fall of last year, it sort of hit bottom sometime around November and has been bobbing around at a okay but not great level ever since. So job market firming, but rather slowly, and also the Conference Board reporting that its measure of help wanted advertising also kind of stuck in a range. It improved in May, June, July of last year, but has been pretty much flat ever since. So we're seeing a slight improvement in the labor market, but not a great one. And it looks like the pace of layoffs has been slowing somewhat, but the pace of hiring has not been accelerating enough to make the job market pick up. The government also, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, also reported that the number of mass layoffs in January rose quite a substantial number by about 40,000-50,000 after trending downward for most of the last half of 2003. January is frequently a month for heavy layoffs because employers, warm-hearted folks that they are, don't like to lay off people just before Christmas, so that they generally postpone layoff announcements till after the new year. And so there are a large number of mass layoffs in January of 2004, a bit more than in January of 2003, and a lot more than we saw at the end of last year. So, again, even though the labor market is improving slightly, it's not improving greatly, and lots of work left to be done in that area. And finally, the measures of consumer confidence continue to fall. The Conference Board's measure fell in January. and ABC Money magazine's has stabilized at a fairly low level after having recovered for a good bit of last year. So it suggests that the weak job market is taking a toll on consumer attitudes, and I think it's shaping the evolution of the election season. A lot of people worried about the economy, worried about the job market, and George Bush's polling numbers are showing that. So if there's no improvement in the job market in the next several months, the unemployment rolls may be joined by a president pretty soon in November. So let's move on and listen to an interview I recorded with Susie Bright, the noted author on sexual matters. She was one of the founders of the lesbian sex magazine On Our Backs and is the editor of the series of Best American Erotica, and also has this new book out called Mommy's Little Girl on... can't remember the subtitle. I'll get it when I return. But she's also appearing tonight at 7 p.m. At Toys in Babeland at 43 Mercer Street in Manhattan. That's 43 Mercer between Grand and Broome. And I'll reannounce that at the end of this interview. And let's listen to Susie Bright. Sex, motherhood, porn, and cherry pie. It's a little bit of a departure for you. Is this kind of a different set of topics and maybe a new audience for you to approach?
It is and it isn't, because some of my audience has been with me since my 20s, when the last thing on our mind was having kids or baking. I mean, I would say that those days were when I'd go on tour and people would, like, bring ropes in their purse to ask me how to do a bondage trick, or they were, like, frightfully upset about the feminist debate about sadomasochistic sex, or, you know, these kind of things. People were very interested in both the controversy and the practical application of sexual adventurism. And then I noticed, right around the time I got pregnant, right around the time I had a baby, people started coming...
Which was what, about 12 years ago?
Yeah, 13 years ago now. People started coming in and saying, you know, I've been a sex radical my whole life. Now I've got a teenage son, and he just told me he wants to see a copy of Playboy. What do I do? And, you know, there we were. We, you know, no one was asking the bondage questions or the whither Andrea Dworkin questions anymore. They wanted to know how to take their intense ideals about sexuality, feminism, liberation politics of all kinds, and now they are confronted with their own children, you know, and you feel like the specter of your parents in the background, you know, you both sympathize with them for the first time, and you also think, I shall never do what they did, never, never. So you try to make an attempt to change the family legacy, you know, all these things come up. So part of my audience is just right there with me. We're all on this same timeline. Also because in this book, although I couldn't cram it into the title, there's also a pretty heavy section on dying and choosing your own way of death, much in the same way that women started taking control of the birthing process. People are starting to say, I want that same kind of direction in planning my own death. Well, all these topics fit my age group. And on the other hand, they are attracting, you know, just new people who thought that I was too, I guess, too out there before. You know, like, Susie Bright is baking a cherry pie? What? with pornography in it? Well, what is she doing now? I mean, it does raise a few eyebrows, I imagine.
Should clarify to the listeners that there really is a cherry pie recipe in it.
A cherry pie recipe, and I'm very proud that the food editor of a very fancy food zine in San Francisco has, in fact, reviewed the book strictly on the recipe's merits. But the rest of the book, really, I wanted to talk about contemporary issues in sexual politics, just like I always have, and I think... thinking about the next generation and thinking about the new attitudes we see towards porn, towards sexual civil rights, towards family relationships, all of that is very much on our minds now.
You're dealing with a couple of taboos here mm-hmm. because in our society, kids aren't supposed to have sexuality,
right.
But moms aren't either.
Right.
So you've got a double barrel bit of taboo.
Yeah, dad's supposed to be really guilty that he wants to have anything to do with it. It's a pretty nasty little group. Yeah, this book puts forward the idea that parents, both mothers and fathers, are sexual. And that even though your sexuality goes through changes in parenthood, it's not that you become a numb rock that doesn't feel, that doesn't have opinions, that doesn't yearn to be touched. I was just talking to a woman earlier today who said that she's worried about that. She wants to start a family, and she imagines being exhausted and losing all desire for sex. And I said, you're not going to stop wanting someone to take care of you and baby you and love you and see you as a woman. No, 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 no. You are not going to feel that way. Yeah, you won't want somebody coming in and saying, where's my hot needle? Where's my hot screw? You know, like, you're not going to want those kind of nagging demands, but you are going to want sexual healing and nurturing and respect and love. Of course you're going to want that, and your partner's going to want that too. So whether you're able to connect in that way, of course, is the challenge, but it's not a matter of not caring anymore. And then the little person or people, that the children that come into your home, of course, you start noticing their sex feelings and their sexuality very early, and they're so innocent of all of our hang-ups and neuroses about sex. And very often parents are afraid to share those stories because they think, is my child unusual? Is someone going to think it's weird or think of me suspiciously?
Despite your reputation as a sex goddess, did you have find yourself with your own kid sort of reverting to traditional morality, some kind of instinct of protection or conservatism?
Huh. That's interesting that you would ask me that now, because my daughter just had her first kiss. And she didn't even tell me. I was not the first person she told. I think in terms of kissing someone else, it made her aware of that mommy was not going to be maybe number one anymore. I mean, I'm starting to get that separation that teenage girls do with their mothers. And so she wasn't sure she wanted to confide anything to me, which was, I was dying. You know, I want to know all the details, and I have to stay cool, have to respect her privacy, her boundaries. But it did allow us, eventually, she stopped being so snooty, and we had a good talk. And I said, you know, I'm aware that you're glad that I'm not a Christian fundamentalist mother like some of your friends' mothers. I know that you're happy of that. But sometimes I wonder if you feel like there's too much pressure perhaps in the other direction. You might be surprised to know that I have protective feelings towards you. I mean, I don't want you to feel like you have to lose your virginity at any certain age just because I've written all about when I lost mine. I said, I don't care if you stay a virgin until you're 44. Of course, she just looked appalled. Notion. I said, it doesn't matter. People put too much emphasis on that. And then she rolled her eyes, and I said, I care about whether this kid is nice to you, whether he's sweet, whether you were happy to be doing what you were doing, you know, that you were as much part of the kissing as he was. And she just rolled her eyes again, but I could tell her answer, you know, her strange grunts and, you know, one word outbursts, she was telling me, yes, he's sweet. Yes, I wanted it. Yes, I'm fine. You don't have to worry about me. But I wanted her to know that I care. I care for her. And I wanted to show up parentally for her. It's different to say you have parental feelings than to say you have neurotic reactionary feelings. I mean, do I feel like telling her she's going to go to hell or that she's a slut? Absolutely not. Do I feel like telling her that no one will marry you if you start kissing at this age? Of course not. I mean, I do not have the secret Jerry Falwell that comes out of me like the Exorcist. I want my daughter to have a real good head on her shoulders about sexuality, and I want her to enjoy it and to stick up for herself and to, you know, not be one of those girls who's like, well, I just went along with it because, you know, it seemed like no one would like me, that kind of thing. Like when those stories about that have surfaced, they've caused such a furor about oral sex in junior high schools. the thing that really galled me was that the oral sex was fellatio that everyone was really talking about. It wasn't that there were all these freshman boys going down on girls, which if there was, I would be applauding. I'd be like, well, it's about time. But no, no one thinks of it from a feminist point of view, that the tragedy of this is that these girls are divorced from their own sexual pleasure, that it's sort of a means to gain popularity or acceptance. That's what's so tragic about it. Not that they have had a sexual experience, per se.
Despite a lot of progress, it seems that a lot of old paradigms stick around.
Oh, it's really dreadful. In fact, in my traveling, I really see this infantilization we've had about sexuality because of AIDS and the resultant morality campaigns, abstinence campaigns. Kids in college are just going through things that I went through in high school, and the dominoes keep falling later and later and later. You find people not having as much sexual experience and maturity as they used to because they've been kept in these little egg cups where they're not supposed to know anything, and where the appearance of sexiness is very important. You know, to look sexy, to have the retail experience of sexiness is paramount.
It's anxiety about the tweenies, you know,
yes.
And their provocative dress.
Yes. Retail titillation is everything. Actual sexual experience and erotic authenticity is nowhere to be found. This is what came up with the whole Janet Jackson breast controversy. You know, what did this actually have to do with sexuality? Nothing. But the notion of what is being sold, what should be sold, how if we buy certain things, we are guaranteed to reach some kind of sexual peak, and yet you never do. You just have to keep buying one more thing. Those problems really influence young people more than anyone else because they have less to compare it to.
I'm speaking with Susie Bright, author most recently of Mommy's Little Girl, on sex, motherhood, porn, and cherry pie, just published by Fender's Mouth Press. There's this great quote in the Washington Times the other day from Gary Bauer, the professional moralist, who said, "Religious conservatives have been doing politics for 25 years, and every front are worse off on things they care about. The gay rights movement is more powerful, the culture is more decadent, the life if not one baby has been saved. Porn is in the living room, and you can't watch the Super Bowl without your hand on the off switch." So, have the likes of you succeeded so much in ruining Gary Bauer's life that just one defeat after another?
Can you wait a moment while I get the world's smallest violin out of my bag so we can do a special little sad song for Gary? Well, that's interesting. I would say, even from his point of view, I would say, Gary, you only have yourself to blame. The way you have fought pornography, the way you have fought abortion rights, the way you have fought sexual liberation is by using these issues to create hysterical titillation, to create hysterical guilt, and those in turn have incited people to investigate those issues further, so that when you show some sleazy guy, you know, tempting a little blonde girl who's trying to walk across the street with her Easter egg basket, you yourself have created a pornographic image of sorts. I mean, this is the kind of literature that Gary Bauer's companions prepare. They use pornographic imagery to critique pornography. They use obscene imagery to attack abortion rights. They never seem to comment on corruption or on a kind of decadence that is part of their entertainment even before Janet Jackson loses her bra cup. The idea that Gary Bauer was having a wonderful time watching the Super Bowl until this one little skit, it's absurd. Wasn't he kind of turned off by the whole thing hours earlier? You know, like, so many offensive things happened before that. Why is this the turning moment for him? It's disingenuous of him to say that. One thing I notice, now this is similar between right-wingers and the left, is that everyone who has a critique of modern capitalism is feeling like They want to get back to basics, goddammit. They want to make an organic loaf of bread. They want to have sex naked without any frills. They want to feel like they did an honest day's work doing something that was meaningful. You know, people are having this back to basics. I want a bar of soap just like the soap that great-grandma used to make. And it seems like the right wing is also yearning for simplicity. Yet their political leadership really has been at the vanguard of using very manipulative and provocative propaganda to push their cause. And, you know, I don't know, he's quite wrong if he thinks that they've had so many setbacks. I mean, they just got the partial birth abortion thing passed. John Ashcroft is, you know, running around to local hospitals demanding that abortion records be pulled from the vaults. Let's get those women and their doctors. You know, it's ugly. The political establishment is more right-wing and more interfering in people's lives than ever before. In fact, people have often commented how funny it is, ironic funny, that Bush's administration, running on the conservative Republican platform of get the government out of people's lives, in fact, they are just crazed for getting the government all in your underwear. I mean, that's what the Patriot Act is all about. That's what so much of their legislation is about, saying, yeah, actually, we are going to come into your bedroom, your kitchen. We're going through your underwear drawer. We've decided we want to say about everything you're up to. And if Gary feels left out of that, all I can say is that he must have been, you know, given a bad seat at the last White House luncheon or something. You know, his comments don't make any sense.
Well, on the other hand, they do seem like, well, they certainly hold positions of power, and you can hardly avoid their moralizing all over the place. But people aren't necessarily listening. People are going on living their lives, and there's like more tolerance of sexual minorities in public life than there's ever been in American history. There's this big disconnect between the official level and people's day-to-day lives.
Well, the unfortunate fact is that the official level controls a lot of what we do in our day-to-day lives. And as much as a lot of us say, you know what, I just try to keep below the radar, doing my own thing, avoiding courts, avoiding confrontations, the fact is, many times in our lives, boom, we're in a situation where with the taxes, with marriage, with death, with hospitalization, with schooling, legal episodes, where suddenly it would be helpful to have a democracy and to have a fair system that wasn't prejudiced against us. Certainly the gay marriage issue brings this to the fore.
And why is it such a big issue now?
Well, I have to say that just by total coincidence, I was in San Francisco on Valentine's weekend and I didn't know what was going to happen. No one knew what was going to happen. When our mayor there decided, hey, you know what, we're just going to do marriages all weekend long, and everyone volunteered to, you know, stay at City Hall and process these marriages, the city just broke into this bloom of love bugginess that was infectious. I mean, I'd walk down to the corner liquor store with the Jordanian immigrant, who certainly isn't gay, and I'd show him the front page, and he had tears in his eyes. Everyone was beside themselves. People were stringing little neon hearts and heart Christmas lights all over their house, and I thought, wow. I mean, I always knew this was the right thing to do, but when you actually see it happening, and you felt this, for a moment we broke through the paranoia and anxiety that has been in this country since 9/11. I mean, for a moment that ended, and there was this sense of brotherliness, I mean that in the human sense, among everyone in the city, and you just felt like, yeah, why is everyone holding this issue up? Why are so many, I'm not surprised at what the right wing has to say about this, because they're obsessed with homosexuality and Leviticus. I mean, they are just off their rocker about it. It's the liberals who've been holding this back. I mean, Barney Frank should be ashamed of himself. He's the gay congressman from Massachusetts who says he doesn't think that Gavin Newsom should have done this in San Francisco. Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, also speaking against it. How dare they? that's why it annoys me, is people you'd think of as being progressive who were being really tight-lipped, like, well, you know, I'll go for that civil union thing, but, you know, I just think we ought to leave this marriage thing alone. I would have loved to just plop them in San Francisco City Hall on that special weekend when this all began and have them experience the tears, the children running everywhere, the families that turned out, these couples, most of them quite old, who would have been together for ages, who were getting married. It was so touching. You just knew it was the right thing to do. And people like me, who had always been so critical of the nuclear family and the institution of marriage, we never saw this coming. You know, it was the last thing on our list. Even Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, the first couple to get married, spoke on this very issue. They said, well, you know, we never cared. But it became one of those deals where it reminded me of early civil rights struggles where people said, we didn't want to eat at this lunch counter. The food is bad at this lunch counter. But then when they said we couldn't eat at this lunch counter, well, we just had to go eat there. I mean, that if they hadn't forced the issue to press the notion that certain people are second class and aren't good enough, that there's something wrong with them, then it wouldn't have come to this. But now it has. And, you know, I know that some people are saying, well, it's because we're so worried about the presidential election. Well, I cannot take that argument seriously any longer, because if you take an immoral stand to reach your compromised goal, you're not going to get what you wanted, and you will have lost the decency that you might have had to begin with. The people who are decent now on this issue, even if somebody like Nader, who had to swallow hard, he'll be glad in the long run that he did, because the people who didn't are going to look pathetic.
I'm speaking with Susie Bright, author most recently of Mommy's Little Girl, on sex, motherhood, porn, and cherry pie, just published by Fender's Mouth Press. Well, one final question. When we talked about a year ago, I guess is the last time we talked, you have, were noting that the submissions for the Best American Erotica were, this was in the run-up of the Gulf, the war in Iraq, you were saying that the men were reporting fantasies of feminization or receptivity. And any social trends you're discerning in the submissions these days?
Well, that book that I was planning last year is now out, Best American Erotica 2004, and it has all those men getting grabbed and forced to do terrible, terrible things. Now, this year, I'm planning 2005, and I don't quite have a brilliant insight into it. I notice lots of things about threesomes and groups. Not that that always isn't a fantasy. You know, it's not like it's unusual, the menage a trois. But there just seems to be more of them. And I wonder what that's a reaction to. Because, as you know, I have this theory that sexual fantasies and erotica responds to whatever is being pressured or repressed in society. The other thing I notice is just a lot more political satire. We're in such partisan times right now that people are doing things that are a little edgier or comment directly on political themes. I have a great story I want to run that is supposedly a dominatrix diary where she just logs in her clients and their likes and dislikes and whether she'll see them again and so on. And you read it, and it's sort of interesting, but then you begin to realize that the client list, John A., that's Ashcroft, Martha S., you know, and then when you read the description of what they like, it's so funny because it's a great insight into their sexual character, responsive to the public image that we see. You know, whatever they rail against is, of course, what they secretly desire in private. And so there's more of that. But if we talk again next year, maybe we can get to the bottom of this unusual threesome thing. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No, well, we're talking about gay marriage as an issue, which is about coupling, and here we are, like, sort of.
Well, maybe. I think that there certainly is so much pressure on monogamy these days so much pressure that there is a polyamorous movement. In fact, it's not just swingers, but people have conventions, you know, to not only have fun with each other, but also to talk about how they feel like the 2x2 Noah's Ark thing just isn't working for them. Now, this is the very thing that anti-gay marriage people have been so afraid of. They say, well, you know, gay marriages, and then there's going to be, you know, three people who want to get married. And
then it's bestiality, isn't it?
Exactly. And did you hear about the woman, there was a county clerk in Colorado who tried marrying a few gay couples quite in innocence. She really didn't know what the big stink was going to be, and some angry fundamentalist came down from the hills with his donkey and said, well, let's see you marry the two of us. And she's very deadpan. She just looked at him and looked at the ass, and she said, he's too young. He's only 3 years old.
Otherwise, they're pretty well matched.
Exactly.
All right, thanks for joining us, Susie Bright.
It's been great.
And that was Susie Bright, interview recorded the other day. She is the author most recently of the book Mommy's Little Girl on Sex, Motherhood, Porn, and Cherry Pie, just published by Thunder's Mouth. And you can see her tonight at Toys in Babeland, 43 Mercer Street, at 7 p.m., 43 Mercer Street in Soho between Grand and Broome Streets. And this is Doug Henn with the show Behind the News, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. And we'll be back to hear from Frieda Berrigan after this word from the Gang of Four. The Gang of Four from their song from the late 70s, early 80s, can't remember exactly when, Contract. And the Arms Trade Resource Center of the World Policy Institute, which you can visit on the web and get this report at worldpolicy.org, has just issued a study of who's making money on Iraq, or who's making money on arms contracting in Iraq. And one of the authors is Frieda Berrigan, and we spoke with her earlier today about the report. So let's listen to Frieda Berrigan.
We all know, I guess most of us know, that Halliburton is making a killing in Iraq, but you've actually put some numbers in all this. So give us the details. How much is Halliburton making on contracts?
Sure. Halliburton is making the biggest killing of all on these contracts, and the numbers are really staggering. In the last year, Halliburton has jumped from being the Pentagon's 37th largest contractor to being the Pentagon's 7th largest contractor. They've leapfrogged over much larger companies to come to this place. Their contracts have increased 700%. In 2002, Halliburton received $483 million in contracts from the Pentagon. This past year, they received $3.9 billion. So we're looking at an increase of 680% in just 1 year.
And what are they doing? Everybody thinks oil when they hear Halliburton, but it's not just oil, right?
It's not just oil. They're doing just about anything that you can imagine. They're building military bases. They're cooking and serving meals. They're washing the clothes of military personnel. They're delivering the mail. They're maintaining military vehicles, so changing the oil, fixing flat tires, that sort of stuff. And then on top of that, they're also they have a huge contract to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure. So it runs the whole gamut from direct services to the military, basically being the maids, in a way, of troops in Iraq to undertaking these large reconstruction projects.
There's been a slight whiff of scandal about some of this. Are they under investigation? How honest are they about when they make up their bills?
A slight whiff of scandal is certainly how Halliburton is treating it and how the Pentagon is treating it, despite the fact that they've launched a criminal investigation of the company. Halliburton has, by my count, almost half a dozen current controversies surrounding it, overbilling the military for delivery of fuel in Iraq, charging almost twice as much as other entities are charging for bringing in fuel from Kuwait into Iraq. So that's one thing. They've overbilled the military for meals that they're serving in military mess halls. And there's the scandal relating to kickbacks that Halliburton employees have are accused of having taken from Kuwaiti subcontractors, millions of dollars in bribes that these individuals took. So there's all of these different things going on. There's also a Pentagon report about food safety conditions in Halliburton's mess halls, that there's blood all over the floor, that basic food safety guidelines are not being followed by the company there. So in the midst of all of this thing, as you mentioned, there is an investigation, but at the same time, Halliburton continues to receive huge contracts from the Pentagon, from the United States. So while on the one hand they're being punished and they're being investigated, on the other hand they're being rewarded, and they're basically going on with business as usual.
Is it too cynical to suspect that some of Halliburton's good fortune comes from the fact that Dick Cheney used to be their CEO?
When you look at all of these scandals, you think, gosh, this is enough to put a company out of business. And then you look at it and you see how they're being treated. They're being treated with kid gloves. It's the only conclusion that I can come up with, that their relationship with Dick Cheney and the power that he wields behind the scenes, in a large part, we can credit that for the way that they're benefiting and from the war, the way that they're profiting, the way that they've jumped from being 37 to 7th, the 680% increase in contracts, and then also how they're sort of immune to scandal.
And, of course, it's not just Halliburton. There are the rent-a-cops at DynCorp, right, and their parent company. Tell us about them.
DynCorp is in Iraq. A number of other private military corporations are in Iraq. They're also experiencing huge increases in Pentagon contracts and will, for the foreseeable future, enjoy huge profits as a result of ongoing war, instability, and then, of course, the occupation.
And DynCorp is active all over the place, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, everywhere the military is, in some places where at least overtly the military isn't, DynCorp is there. They're flying helicopters in Colombia. They're on the ground in the Philippines. They're all throughout former Yugoslavia and the Balkans region. And they're in Afghanistan. You name it, they're there. Very low-key, off-the-radar screen sort of U.S. military presence there, allowing the military to have some plausible deniability, to allow the administration to have some plausible deniability around the exertion of military force throughout the world.
It looks to me like the Pentagon is relying more on private contractors to do its work than it used to. Is that a fair impression?
Yes, very much. There's been a concerted effort ever since Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense back at the beginning of the 90s, to privatize a lot of the roles of the military. One thing that's really been hammered home in this most recent war and occupation is that the Pentagon and the military force structure is now completely dependent on companies like Halliburton to provide all of these services. The military doesn't have the personnel anymore to wash its own clothes and cook its own meals and erect its own bases. They're now completely dependent on it. And Dick Cheney, as Secretary of Defense, really set that all in motion. What we're looking at now is that for every 10 military personnel, for every 10 soldiers in Iraq, there's one private military personnel. So somebody who's not wearing a uniform, but who is carrying a weapon and is in a support capacity for the military. Just by way of contrast, during the first Gulf War in 1991, that ratio was 1 in 100. So for every 100 troops, there was one private military personnel. And I think that this is a really a growing problem because it sort of masks the costs of the war in terms of its impact on Americans and on our sort of political, how we make decisions about war, how we make decisions about intervention. We don't have to institute a draft. We don't have to call up all of the reservists. There are estimates that if we didn't have companies like Halliburton and DynCorp in Iraq, the number of troops there would have to be at least double. There are about 135,000 troops currently in Iraq. Retired Air Force general who was quoted in a recent New Yorker article on Halliburton said that without Halliburton there, that number would have to be about 300,000 troops. So it allows the administration to sort of cover up the costs of the war. It makes going to war politically a lot easier because we're relying on fewer men and women in uniform, but the people power is still there, and certainly the economic costs, I think, are much higher because we're relying more and more on these private companies.
And I'm guessing also that some familiar names are raking in it as well, classic arms contractors as well as these relative newcomers.
That's right. There's so much focus on Halliburton. You can't open the newspaper each day without seeing some reference to them. But there is this whole other class of corporations that are continuing to benefit from war, and those are the weapons manufacturers. So Lockheed Martin, for instance, which is the largest weapons manufacturer in the world, based in Bethesda, Maryland, its increase in contracts from 2002 to 2003 is larger than the whole pot of contracts that Halliburton has gotten. Their increase was 28% from 2002 to 2003, and they were awarded $21 billion in contracts last year. And as we look at other weapons manufacturers, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, they all increased substantially and are running their assembly lines essentially 24 hours a day to replenish the stocks of weapons that were used in Iraq.
Well, I guess though the rest of the economy is having a hard time recovering, the military economy is doing quite well for itself.
And that was an interview recorded earlier today with Frieda Bergen, who is with the Arms Trade Resource Center at the World Policy Institute, talking about who's making a killing off Iraq contracting. And she pointed out, edit out part of the interview, but she did point out that military spending over the next 5 years is projected to total about $2.2 trillion, massive amounts of money. Alan Greenspan was saying we need to cut Social Security and Medicare to balance the budget, but that $2.2 trillion is off limits in the current political environment. Let's hear this commentary from the Gang of Four, and we'll be back with Mark Levita.
All my taking.
And that was the Gang of Four from their 25-year-old song, Guns Before Butter. Keep quiet, no room for doubt. That's America Today. And now we're joined on the line by Mark Levitan, who is a senior policy analyst with the Community Service Society and the author of a report on the New York City job market, whose headline is A Crisis of Black Male Employment. So let's get the overview of the city job market in the year 2003 and then focus on the particular distress of black men in New York City. Welcome to WBAI, Mark.
Thank you very much.
So, not a good year, 2003, was it?
No, it's not a good year. It's probably the high point of joblessness in the current recession. I think the recovery we're going to see this year is going to be rather anemic, but probably 2003 will be the year where we will have seen the highest unemployment rate in the current recession. So 2003 was as bad as it's probably going to get for a little while.
So your report compares what we assume is going to be the bottom year of 2003 with the peak year of 2000. So
exactly.
Give us the rundown on what happened to the unemployment rate.
Well, the unemployment rate went up, as it always does in a recession. In 2000, the citywide unemployment rate was 5.7%, and in 2003 was 8.4%. What's troubling, though, is when we look at these unemployment rates by race and by ethnicity. And here we see quite a big disparity. The white unemployment rate in the city went from about 3.5% to 6%. The black unemployment rate went from about 7.5% to 13%. And the Hispanic unemployment rate went from 8% to 10%.
And, of course, the reason the unemployment rate rose is because jobs disappeared. How many jobs disappeared over the last several years?
About 240,000 jobs were lost in this period.
And what industries led the way down?
Well, the two largest the industries that had the largest declines in employment were financial activities and business services. They both lost more than 50,000 jobs apiece between 2000 and 2003. Right behind them was manufacturing, which is becoming a very small industry in the city, but lost more than 45,000 jobs in just those 3 years.
Of course, the national figures in manufacturing are stunning, 42 consecutive months of job loss in manufacturing.
Right.
Now, how does the city's job loss compare with the national figures?
Well, on a percentage basis, it's about three times the national rate of job loss.
And, of course, our unemployment rate is, what, about 2 percentage points higher in most categories?
Well, it's we're saying 5.7%, and I'm sorry, it was about 5.6% for the nation in 2003, and, you know, in, here in the city, we were at 8.4%, so it's quite a bit higher here.
And now, looking at from the other side, the unemployment rate in New York City is not necessarily a very good measure of what's going on in the job market because so many people are not looking for work, and therefore they're counted as discouraged workers who are then not officially unemployed.
Exactly.
So another way of looking at things is the percentage of the adult population that's working, the so-called employment population ratio. And here in New York City is way off from national averages, right?
Right. We're really the capital of joblessness in America. When we look at this more comprehensive gauge of what's happening to the city's population, the numbers look very, very troubling. And the disparities between men and women, and the disparities across the race ethnic groups become even sharper.
So give us the rundown.
Okay, well, let's first talk about men and women. For men, the decline in employment was from about 73% to 68%, about 5.5 percentage point decline, where for women, the decline was much more modest, only about 2.2 percentage points. But when we look within men, among men, by race and ethnicity, what we see is for white men a change of about 2 percentage points. For black men, 12 percentage points, and for Hispanic men, 7 percentage points. So by 2000, 2003, just to use round numbers, about 75% or three-quarters of the city's white men were employed. About two-thirds of the city's Hispanic men were employed, and just over half the city's black men were employed.
And these, again, are well below national averages.
Well below national averages for all the groups. But the situation for black men is really, I think, at a crisis point.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, this should be considered a social emergency. You really don't hear people talking about it very much. But why are so few black men employed?
Well, I think we have to talk about this in sort of two time frames. One is what's happened in the recession, and then what's happened in over a longer period of time. It's really not unusual for recessions to take a higher toll on male job holding than female job holding, and on black, Hispanic, and younger men job holding than white men or older men's job holding. That really is typical of any downturn. So that's not really news. It's bad news, but it's not a shockingly new development. Here's what I'm concerned about. When we look at black men over a longer period of time, what we see is that they got the least out of the prior economic expansion. So we really are in a situation looking over the last 10 years of black men being classically the last hired and the first fired. They got the least benefit from the expansion and the hardest hit in the recession. And the question that the report really raises is, are we seeing not simply a recession-related development, but a longer-term structural change in the city labor market that is putting black men in an ever greater disadvantage?
And I know it's too early to tell, but do you have a feeling yet?
Well, I do have a feeling, and I think the answer is yes. I mean, we will get a better sense of this as the economy recovers and as more people get drawn into employment, and we'll look and see what happens, whether black men rebound as the economy once again expands. I'm skeptical. And I'm skeptical because the employment opportunities that have opened up in the city for people without a college degree are increasingly low-wage jobs in the service sector. And what the data indicate is that Hispanic men have been able to find employment in that sector. Hispanic and black women have been able to find employment in that sector, but black men have not. But that's the growth sector.
And we don't know why.
Well, we don't know why in a definitive sense. I think we can make some educated guesses. And I think there are sort of two questions to ask here. One is, why do so many black male job seekers have a tough time finding work? And there, I think you have to keep in mind that even when the local economy was going great guns, we had pretty high unemployment rates here in New York City. At the peak year, 2000, we had a citywide unemployment rate of 5.7%. Nationally, the unemployment rate was 4%. And if we looked at less skilled, less educated, folks in the city, we'd see that their unemployment rates were pretty high even at the peak of the boom. So we've had for many years a buyer's market. Employers get to pick and choose who they want to hire. They've got a large pool of applicants. And in that context, employers have, this has been measured in a lot of different ways. Employers have a stereotype, and they have a preference. And in their ordering of preferences, black men are at the bottom of the list.
Well, that's a social tragedy and a social crime.
It is.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Mark Levitan.
My pleasure. I wish I had better news.
I wish you did, too. I've been speaking with Mark Levitan, who is a senior policy analyst with the Community Service Society, and you can visit them on the web at cssny.org. And Download that report if you like. A Crisis of Black Male Employment, Unemployment, and Joblessness in New York City, 2003. I think we're going to return to this topic a lot in the coming months. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with yet another word from the Gang of Four.